You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Adam Benforado, hailing from Spain many, many years ago, Professor at Drexel University of Law, and his principal interest is in applying insights from the mind sciences, most notably cognitive psychology, to law and legal theory. The book we're going to talk about is Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. Now, when I, Hunter Motz, of course, found this book, and I was getting texts as he was reading, going, you got to read this book. It's amazing. And it's fascinating because you open the book with kind of a bold premise, and that is you describe how justice was administered, at least in Europe, 900 years ago, and that was typically done with water. Let's use that as an example. You're guilty. You're innocent. We'll find out by throwing you in holy water. If the water rejects you, in other words, if you float, you are guilty. If you sink, obviously, the holy water doesn't mind having you in its embrace. You are, in fact, innocent. And you kind of then go on to say, which really hooked me into this book, you then say, we're going to look back 900 years from now, maybe even less, and say, and I would argue less after reading your book, maybe even in 50 years, and say that our current justice system is unjust, is very inexact, very unscientific. And you come up with countless examples of this, and it's very hard to refute your argument. A couple examples are, if you're being tried and they're trying to arrive at a guilty or innocent verdict and it's just before lunch, you're kind of shit out of luck because chances are you're going to be found guilty because the judge and the jury are hungry. That's just one tiny example. The positioning of the camera when you are giving your confession or at least being interrogated by a police officer has everything to do with whether or not that evidence is damning or not, because you can't see what the cop is doing to get this confession out of you. And if the camera's positioned from the perspective of the police officer, or it's positioned on the side where you see both parties, it makes a huge difference. This is a long introduction. Professor, welcome to the mother of all shows.
Thanks so much.
Welcome to the mother of all shows. Brian Callen Show, and I always say the Brian Callen Hunter Motz Show. So, first of all, what got you into this science? I can't wait to get into this. This is one of those books where I said, we're not going to have enough time to ask you 1,000 questions. So go ahead and talk.
So it was really, it started for me in law school. So, first day, I'm not from a law family, and so I step into, Harvard Law School, and I didn't really know what to expect, and I sort of thought, that it would be a little bit like medical school, except instead of, learning all of the bones of the body, I'd be learning just all of the legal rules. And then, I'd memorize them all, and I'd go off and be a great lawyer because, I know what was moving the legal system. And even my first semester, I started to have doubts about what really mattered. It started to seem to me that really it was the judge's psychology which was determining how cases came out and not what the letter of the law said. And so I sought out some of the dissenting voices on the faculty, started working with this guy, John Hansen, who runs the project on law and mind sciences at the law school. And it was then that I just started devouring the latest research from psychology and neuroscience. And the more that I read, the more that I became convinced that our entire legal system is really based on unsupported myths about how humans behave. And so I decided to write this book. I've been a professor, law professor, for about 7 years. And, in that time, I've started working with psychologists, actually developing experiments. And I decided to write this book because I thought that the broad public needed to understand the truth about the forces that shape the behavior of detectives and judges and jurors and witnesses. I'm now, you know, the book's out and hoping to bring that message to everyone.
It fascinated me. I mean, just for example, that powerful example of a skinny man is more likely to convict a fat woman, if she's fat. And it's almost as though when you drop people in water 900 years ago, if they were heavy, typically they would float. So we haven't come that far necessarily, least in some instances.
And that's why I wanted to start with that example, because, I mean, it's, you know, the idea of the trial by ordeal, which is this was the thing you were describing, was the cold water ordeal where, you know, when there were no witnesses and other evidence, well, how else would you tell whether someone was guilty or not? Well, throw them into holy water and see if they sink or float, because God would intervene in such matters. And, I mean, it seems so absurd to us looking back. I mean, it's the stuff of comedy, really.
Yeah. Well, you use Monty Python.
Monty Python actually uses the trial by ordeal in the Holy Grail, and I think that we look at that with the eyes of people who feel like we've come so far and we're so enlightened. But if you actually think about it, right, the people then, the system they had in place seemed to work, and it seemed to be grounded in, you know, the truth, in accurate principles and accurate approaches. And if you look at our legal system now, my argument is you're going to see the same flaws, the same type of blind adherence to, you know, really untested theories about, you know, what deceit looks like and, you know, what causes people to commit crimes that are not any more, you know, tested out than what it was 900 years ago.
And I think the interesting thing is you talk about those myths about neuroscience, and I think when you scratch the surface, some of them become very obvious. Like the one that really stood out for me was the idea that you can tell the jury to disregard something that they've heard, as if, like, we can just, like, rewind the tape on your memory and you can unhear that. We all know that that's not really how people work.
I mean, that to me is just a shocking thing. So I have always, you know, I teach criminal law. I have always wanted to be on a jury, and I always get cut. And about a couple years ago in Philadelphia, I made it past the initial sort of cut, and the jury was actually, you know, given these questionnaires. And, you know, one of the questionnaires is there any reason why you know, would be more or less likely to believe the testimony of a police officer? And a bunch of people, you know, on the jury panel sort of, you know, checked that box. And the judge pulled everyone aside who checked that box and said, okay, let me explain to you what objectivity means. That just means that we all have these feelings. You've just got to set them aside for the trial.
Yeah.
Everyone in the jury said, yeah, okay, judge, I understand. So that was like, what a farce, right?
Yeah. It's like saying, don't think of an elephant, right?
Right.
Whatever you do.
Exactly. And just the psychological evidence says that's just not possible. We can't just decide to flip a switch and be objective. And in fact, even judges, right, are unable to flip the switch. So when it comes to disregarding, say, prejudicial evidence or testimony, they themselves, I mean, they can even deliver that instruction to the jury and yet still be influenced by that that evidence that's not supposed to come
in. Well, a book like this also kind of, for me, you know, forced me to face up to a lot of my prejudicial thinking. You know, I have children. I was making this joke about when I'm on vacation, I'm worried about sunblock and kidnappers. and when you kind of were like, yeah, you might be worried about, you know, a sexual deviant kidnapping your child, who wouldn't be? But the chances are literally as slim as getting struck by lightning, or slimmer. You car accidents,
yeah,
and diabetes kill way more people, obviously. That's the real deadly sort of, you know, the lion in the tall grass there.
Absolutely. I mean, I was on a plane, this is 3 or 4 years ago, and I'm sitting next to a guy. He asks what I do. I tell him I'm a, you know, criminal law professor, and he starts telling me about how he has a daughter and he's really worried. He just got on the internet and, you know, looked up where the child predators were in his neighborhood. Mm. And there was one basically between, you know, his daughter's, where they lived, and his daughter's best friend's house. And so he was really worried if she's going to ride her bike over. And his wife, you know, thinks that they should allow her to ride the bike. And I said, man, you know how unlikely it is that your daughter will ever be attacked by one of these child predators, recidivists. Like, it's like tiny, tiny percentage. And I said, do you ensure that your daughter always wears her bicycle helmet? And he said, no, I don't really think. I said, do you know, like, the streets she crosses? Are they busy? I said, if you want to worry about stuff, you need to worry about, like, your daughter falling off her bike. Like, yeah. That's the scary thing. And the people, you know, when it comes to child predators that are actually a threat, it's not the pedophile hiding in the bushes. It's, you know, it's our friends and neighbors.
Yeah, it's somebody you know. It's a relative, yeah.
Yeah, and the unfortunate thing is a lot of our legal policy isn't based on the statistical analysis when it comes to something like risk assessments. It's based on people's gut feelings, and there are certain things that people are more frightened of. Well, and so yeah. That determines, you know, where we put police officers, what things are prohibited and what are legal.
That's what this book did for me. I had to face up to that. That's exactly, I was like, man, my fears are pretty irrational if you look at them from a statistical point of view or if you look at them from a scientific point of view. And, you know, the other thing, and I want to talk about this, you know, you make the case that a great deal of violent offenders and people really just generally in jail have a form of brain damage. There is a lot of evidence to suggest, for example, that serial killers have different brains. Mm-hmm. And so it raises this question for me. If indeed, and by the way, there is even evidence that pedophiles, I did a TV show called Seventh Heaven, and Stephen, what's his last name? The star of that show. I can't believe I'm forgetting his last name. I knew him very, very well. But he was convicted of, or at least he has been, he admitted in therapy that he showed his genitals to some 13-year-old girl.
Stephen Collins.
Now, then there was an article in the New York Times about how pedophilia, it could very well be a neurological affliction. It could be a form of mental illness, let's just say. Mm-hmm. And let's say when you have an inexplicable urges, and you use a couple of examples of the guy with the tumor who had this, he was going to rape his landlady and was just propositioning people, and then he had the tumor removed, then it came back and the urges came back. And so if we are able then to prove through brain science that criminal behavior like pedophilia, like being a serial killer, is in fact a form of mental illness, brain damage. Mm-hmm. What does that say about punitive measures? What does it say is, how do we punish those people? And should they instead be in a hospital, et cetera? These are the questions it raises. It's kind of fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, the starting point as I started to confront the evidence was to start to realize that we need to make radical changes to the way we punish and the way that we think about our correction system. And I think, you know, the evidence that you've just pointed to, when you start to really take the neuroscience seriously, when you start to say, you know, all human behavior has its origins in the brain. Electrochemical reactions beyond our conscious awareness or control are really determining.
You know, Professor, I'm going to stop you here because I can hear a lot of religious people saying, hold on, what does that say about free will? What does that say about the devil? What does that say about, you know, now you're really bucking against a tradition that's been around really since at least, I mean, my God, 10,000 years if you go back to the Upanishads or whatever it is. You know?
So I think if you come from a religious perspective.
I had to drop Upanishads there, sorry.
And you believe in a soul, and you believe that there is inherent good and there's inherent bad in the world, if you believe in original sin, then I think you can maintain a blame-based system. I think that still makes sense. I think if you believe that actually, you know, our brains control behavior and the idea of free will, if you really confront the science, in my opinion, suggests that the thing that we believe is free will really doesn't exist. And if you take it far enough, I think you come to a conclusion that we should not base our system around blame anymore. We should take a public health model to crime and see it in the same way that we see a lot of other mental health issues. So it used to be, in certain countries, someone with Tourette's was actually seen as evil and a criminal.
Yeah.
And at some point, we started to understand, well, actually, the reason that this person is acting in this way is not because they have some evil spirit in them. It's not because they are choosing to do these bad things. It's because of their brain chemistry.
Well, there's measurable evidence, isn't there?
Exactly. And I think that we are just at the beginning of starting to understand a lot more about the causes in the brain that lead people to commit crimes. And so to the extent that we look at the data and we say, look at the number of people locked up in our prisons who've suffered traumatic brain injuries. Look at the number of people here who have other severe mental health issues. It starts this idea that the people we punish somehow deserve it, have somehow chosen the path of crime. It starts to really break down. And I think if you think about what it would be like to live in a world where we didn't say, shake our finger at criminals and say, you're an evil person and you deserve to suffer, I think that's actually a realistic vision. I think that means not that we would allow dangerous people to be out in our communities. There are some people who couldn't control themselves, and those people would need to be, I think, detained. But I think the idea that that detainment, that condition ought to be in a, locked up in a cement box for 30 years, I think that's what would change. And certainly we put a lot more emphasis onto rehabilitating people, helping them rather than hurting them, which is our current approach is, you've done something bad, we are going to hurt you. Mm-hmm. We are going to make you suffer. Well,
we're going to put you in solitary confinement.
Yeah.
That section of the book was horrifying. We really haven't, it hasn't changed, has it? Solitary confinement.
It's gotten worse, yeah. If anything.
When I started to just look at the data and start to understand what solitary confinement does to a person, I just reached the conclusion that this has got to change, and this has got to change right now. And the most shocking thing is just the fact that, solitary confinement can be used for people who haven't even had trial yet.
Rikers
Island.
Yeah, I went and saw that in Miami-Dade County. I saw what we do with our mentally ill, by the way, is we put them in a glass aquarium with a steel cot, and they get a nylon smock. And I went and saw that and spent a week in Miami-Dade County Jail just because I was going to write a TV show about it. And I got psoriasis. I got so stressed out that I broke out into literally huge, I couldn't understand what the hell was going on.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how awful it was.
And if you think about just from an empirical scientific perspective, you take someone with mental illness and put them in an environment where they have to follow rules and there are serious consequences to breaking any rule. Well, what do we know? We know people with severe mental illness, they can't do that, right? And so as soon as they screw up, what's the punishment in prison? Well, solitary confinement.
Yeah.
And what does that do to someone who already has existing mental
makes
health
them
issues?
Makes them worse. Makes
them far worse. And then what do we do?
Let them go.
Most of those people end up back in our community.
We free them.
So it's just a terrible system. The only people who benefit from that system, the people running the prison
That's
for
right.
profit. Those are the only people who have a vested interest in keeping things the way they are.
That's right. And they're a powerful union.
They are. And the interesting thing, though, is I think we're at a moment where conservatives and liberals actually can join together on this issue. Liberals can come forward and say, well, this is inhumane. You shouldn't treat people like this. This is a human rights issue. And some conservatives may care about that. Other conservatives may come forward and say, you know what? This is a fiscal responsibility.
Mm-hmm. It's also
and it's a waste of money.
It's a waste of money because it's ineffective.
Exactly. Right. So if you're a fiscal Republican and you're looking at this, well, why should tax dollars be going to something that makes people more dangerous, that leaves all of us less safe? That's just imprudent.
Exactly.
Right. You're increasing criminality rather than reducing it, which is
exactly.
the goal of the legal system.
What I found encouraging, though, as we learn more about brain science was, and I'm always skeptical of, and things do change, but trying to get those vested interests to give up their interests and their powerful lobbying group. Things do change in this country fairly quickly, but I was kind of encouraged with the notion that if we can start isolating what exactly is wrong in someone's brain, which we're getting better at, then there's probably going to be cures for some of these problems as well.
Yeah, and I think that's really going to be, I think, where we're going to be seeing changes in the next 50 to 100 years is better ways both to intervene, but more importantly, prevent people from ever committing crimes. Mm-hmm. And we're just learning more and more about things like exposure to heavy metals, right? For a long time, we let kids, eat lead paint chips and thought, well, what's that going to do to them? Nothing. And now we start to know, oh gosh, actually, that changes people's brains, and actually it's correlated with increased likelihood of committing crimes, particularly violent crimes later in life.
Jesus.
The more that we can start to intervene with kids, get them out of bad environments, get them away from toxins that are linked to criminal behavior later on. I think we can really prevent a lot of the problems I discuss in the book.
Has there been any research on sugar and brain and for kids?
So there's a lot of research on, I think, the effects of sugar generally on the brain, not, to my knowledge, linking it to criminal behavior.
Right.
But most of it has been, with respect to sort of micronutrients, heavy metals. But there's a lot of stuff that changes brain chemistry and that appears to be linked with later criminal behavior. And I think the more we understand about that stuff, and there's a lot of work still left to do, the more we can just avoid, you don't have to worry about the problems with solitary confinement if someone never commits the crime in the first place.
Exactly, and save money prevention.
Well, and I mean, I thought the most telling example was Charles Whitman.
Yeah.
I mean, this, you think about Full Metal Jacket, like you think about just our idea of this guy who climbed up into a tower and shot 16 people at Texas A&M.
Mm-hmm.
You think of him as, a monster, or maybe he's someone who was ruined by going through the experience of war. Turns out he actually had a brain tumor. And for the year leading up to it, he was like, he couldn't understand what was happening to his brain. He went into doctors and nobody was able to give him an answer. And that's the sort of thing where now we would treat him, and he wouldn't have the chance to climb up that tower. Instead, he would get help.
Mm. Yeah, and I think we have to be courageous in moving away from this model, which just says, "Well, that was an evil dude,"
mm-hmm.
and there's evil in our world, and when it happens, we need to stamp it out. But there's nothing we can do to prevent it. I mean, I completely reject that notion. And I say there's lots of things that we can do to avoid these problems. Mental health screening is a really big one of them.
Mm. Well, I've always, doing this podcast and interviewing people like yourself who are really making a difference and thinking deeply on these issues, I've become quite an optimist, actually, because I think every problem has a solution. I really do. I think that's the way at least we should approach our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And when I talk, when I read books like this, Unfair, what is the caption on this?
Unfair,
The New Science of Criminal Injustice.
Yeah, it's such a good book because it makes me so optimistic. There are answers, and they don't necessarily take a lot of money sometimes. It just takes a different perspective. And it just takes, knowing that, in fact, if you look at the measurable science, it does throw these ancient paradigms, the idea of free will, the idea of good and evil, the idea that you are responsible for your own actions, which I think are good things to an extent. I'm still not ready to give up on that stuff.
There is truth to them
yes.
as well.
Yeah.
I think
yes,
that's the thing.
Yes, discipline exists and you need it. But
I mean, it's not entirely genetics and heavy metals, but the point is that if we're interested in justice, then we have a responsibility to find out what happened here. And then, even if the person did commit the crime, then how do we ensure that they become, hopefully a contributing member of society, if that's possible, rather than a sociopath who is created by loneliness.
Yes. And Professor, let me ask you this, though. Isn't there a lot of evidence that strong communities produce a lot less crime and a lot less of this mental illness?
Absolutely. So I think it's always, you know, to get the complete story, you've always got to look at nature and nurture. I think there's a side that's the neuroscience side, which looks at sort of brain chemistry, traumatic brain injuries, all of that kind of stuff. And then there's a side of it which is about social influence. And the big part of criminality has to do with the environments which breed people to become criminals. And that's not just, you know, the neighborhood you grew up in, you know, what your parents were like, you know, what your social interactions were like. That's also, you know, in the particular moment when you were thinking about, on the fence about thinking about committing a crime, the proximate influences on your behavior. And so there's tons of research on how, you know, people who appear totally, you know, good, normal people can, through very subtle manipulations, be led to engage in criminal, dishonest actions all the way to very, very criminal behavior.
Oh, yeah. You can.
Right. And I think the thing that comes to mind is also, I mean, it's even how we look at, for example, the Nazis, right?
Yeah.
There's this narrative that develops that, you know, I mean, how people respond to that. Was it a small group of incredibly bad people who led, you know, a bunch of good people astray? Is it something about the German cultural psyche that makes it possible? Or is it that, you know, all people have within them the capacity to go psycho and try and kill the outsiders?
That's pretty common. I have the face of a choir boy, and I'm a total pervert. So, you know, you gotta look at those things.
So I think that debate that went on after the Second World War actually spawned a lot of the really interesting psychological research. So, you know, Stanley Milgram, who any listeners who, you know, are familiar with his shocking experiments, where he brought in, you know, collected a bunch of people in New Haven, Connecticut, brought them in and told them, okay, you guys are going to be, you know, participating in this learning experiment. Every time, you know, the learner gets something wrong, an answer wrong, you're supposed to give them a shock, and you're supposed to go all the way up to 450 volts. And the experimenters, you know, they said, well, how many people actually go all the way up to 450 volts, XXX, you know, the participant in the other room is complaining of a heart condition, they go silent after something like, you know, 300 volts. How many people are going to go all the way up to 450 volts? And they asked, actually, psychologists. I think the psychologist said, well, 1 out of 1,000. Only the sadists would go all the way up to 450 volts. And what it ended up being? It was something like 2/3
unbelievable
of people went all the way up. And to me, that definitely sides on the argument that we're all capable of doing dark things.
Well, it's always
under the right environmental conditions.
Human beings fall into those us versus them camps so easily.
Quickly,
we are very tribal, and the other thing we are is very irrational. You know, the idea that I was listening to a Radiolab podcast about
Brian. Don't reference other people's products.
Sorry.
I was listening. You were listening to an episode of the Brian Callen Show.
Of course. Yeah. But about the nature of random acts and how a statistician would look at anything that would seem like an incredible coincidence. A girl in England, her name is Laura Dunham, and she lets a balloon go with her name on it, and 140 miles away it lands in the backyard of a 10-year-old girl named Laurel Dunham. They had the same name. They also had the same black lab. And oh, by the way, they had a guinea pig with the same beige spot on their ass. Now, the chance that a statistician actually goes, actually, it is a crazy coincidence, but it's not rare. Yeah. It's not rare in terms of what you would think. Winning the lottery twice in a day or twice in a year is not, even though the chances are 1 in a trillion, it isn't, if you look at the grand scheme of things, it's not that rare. It happens a lot more. And yet, when you measure the world from your own experience, that's a sign from God.
That's why we need evidence-based justice. I mean, I think that when individual judges, individual prosecutors, individual police officers are out there, they don't notice these patterns, right?
Right.
They don't notice the flaws in the models they're operating in, and it's only when you look at the data. So, you know, you mentioned in the opening this study out of Israel on, you know, when people are granted parole or denied parole. So, you know, before reading that study, I would have said, well, the things that must determine it are how bad a crime the person committed and, you know, whether they reform themselves in prison. But when the researchers looked at the data of real parole boards in Israel, what did they find? Well, the thing that was determining it was simply the time of day when the parole board met. And again, you're not going to see that. No judge is going to realize that until you accumulate all that data, you analyze it, and you present it. And then it's like, wow, we need to do something about this, because that is not, of things that are not supposed to determine whether someone gets parole or not, the time of day, that's definitely high on the list.
Well, and more than time of day, it's how recently you had a meal, right? I mean, it's so primal. And as I recall, the statistics were that if, you know, you came up before the parole board and they just had a meal, then you had a 65% chance of getting a favorable review. And if it was right before they had a meal, then you had a 0% chance.
Yeah, and so the working theory is that all of us, it's about mental fatigue, and when we are depleted, we're more likely to just go with the status quo, no matter what our occupation is. And if you're on a parole board, the status quo is just leave the guy in prison, right?
It's
Let him
incredible.
Serve out his sentence.
It's just incredible to me. That's so scary and so crazy, and that's what's so shocking and amazing about the book. I hope... And I don't know if you know, has anybody in the justice system read this book? Have they? Is this science that's being available? Are you having an impact?
So I am biased, obviously. but yes, of course I'm having an impact. So it's actually very cool.
Ready? So has this book permeated any the justice system? Has anybody in the justice system actually read the book?
Yes. So that's actually, you know, the book's only been out a couple of weeks, but it's been really exciting to just get emails from judges and lawyers and actually police officers. That was one of the most surprising things to me was, you know, I heard from, in particular, I exchanged several emails with a police officer in New Jersey who started a new group focused on evidence-based policing. And they actually were just out in California, a bunch of police officers from around the country who have been sort of pushing on their own for their departments to adopt better practices when it comes to eyewitness identifications and interrogation procedures. And this gives me great hope. You know, I just did an event last week up at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, and the person who actually was the moderator was a judge. And she said, you know, Adam, these are things that I wish that I had known, and I am going to be pushing the other judges I know need to read this book. So I feel like...
That's so cool. That's so cool, man.
Yeah, yeah. And I feel like it's largely because of actually the tragedies that we've been watching in the news over the last several months. I think the public is ready for reform in the criminal justice system in a way that they just haven't been for, honestly, decades.
Yeah.
All the major... You know, presidential candidates have criminal justice platforms, right? That's unthinkable 10 years ago that would happen. And so I'm really excited. I my goal in writing this book, why I'm an academic, I could have written an academic press book. Instead, you know, I took an extra year editing it down from 600 pages down to something that people would actually read. And I did that because I want to change the way we're doing things. There are too many people being harmed under deeply unfair practices. And I think we have a rare opportunity to actually make changes.
And well, if there was ever a time to, for the listeners out there, to write to your legislator, write to presidential candidates, prime ministerial candidates, you know, tweet this book at them.
And Unfair, the New Science of Criminal Injustice.
Yeah, and I mean, honestly, the starting point is just care about it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, the news cycle, there's going to be something else that comes up in the next few weeks. You know, there's going to be Ebola's going to come back, or there's going to be something else. And that's my fear, is just that we lose the focus. Right now, I feel like a critical mass of Americans is demanding change. We cannot continue to lock up the same number of people that we do.
We
need to change practices.
You make suggestions, and really interesting suggestions, for reform. Like, for example, this is so crazy, and it's one of those things where you're like, why didn't I think of this? Avatars so having sort of you're trying somebody, but you don't get to see whether they're fat, black, Asian, whatever. You have to kind of you have an avatar. It's a sort of a, I don't know what how you would describe it, but kind of like, let's just say it's just sort of an amorphous mass, and you have to only look at the evidence.
Yeah, so the whole idea of why someone ought to be convicted is when you apply the law to the facts of the case. And yet, what we know from experimental evidence is all this other seemingly irrelevant stuff often determines the course of the trial. And so it occurred to me, well, why do we need all of that stuff, right? All the stuff that makes for great television makes for really poor justice, right? So it shouldn't matter what kind of tie the defense attorney is wearing or whether the prosecutor gestures in a certain way. It shouldn't matter whether the witness, right, happens to be attractive. Well, research suggests that more attractive witnesses are more believable. Well, that shouldn't have any influence at all. And so in the book, one of the things I was thinking about, and again, this is a long-term project, is, well, why not move the criminal justice space into a virtual space where we can control for all of these biasing factors? And I started to think, well, is that so crazy? It sounds crazy, but is that so crazy?
Sounds fair.
Well, you know, it's really interesting if we actually think about, you know, orchestras. For a long time, orchestras did auditions where they looked at people. And what they found was they weren't getting any women, you know, first violinists. Because when they looked at people, their gender biases came into play. So they started instituting blind auditions where they just heard a person. After all, with music, it's supposed to be about what you're hearing. And what happened as soon as they moved to blind auditions, a lot more women got first chair.
God.
So it seems like just an intuitive thing to me. Well, why not think about this for our justice system also?
Yeah, I mean, but this is all happening in an exponential rate too. I feel like the science is building on itself, and I can't help but feel like we're going to be, we'll have a very different justice system 15 years from now. Do you think it's going to be that soon, or do you think it's going to take longer?
I would love it if it was that soon. I don't think it's going to be. I would love it, but I think it's going to be about incremental change. I think the first step is to adopt some of the more routine things, which just happen to be like how you conduct an eyewitness identification, or when a suspect comes in for an interrogation, how does that interrogation proceed? Those are like things that could make such a big difference, and aren't, you know, the idea of virtual trials is going to rub some people the wrong way. It is.
Yeah.
The idea of, well, when you're conducting a lineup, you probably shouldn't know who the suspect is because you're likely to, you know, subtly influence the eyewitness towards the person. That seems like something we can get all Americans to agree. Well, that doesn't make any sense to continue with that procedure. So I think, again, I think that virtual trials are where we are heading.
It's going to have to be up to the defendant himself. I think if I want to be represented, and I see if I'm a young, attractive guy, which I obviously am,
right.
And when I say young, I'm comparing myself to, say, rocks or dinosaurs. But still, when I'm going to want, if my lawyer says you're a charming guy, let's get you out there because some people might have seen you do stand up or whatever it might be. I'm gonna take advantage. I want the option, man, of defending myself. But so I think you'll get into constitutional issues there about whether or not you're trying me or you're trying a virtual avatar of myself.
Yeah.
Well, that's not really me, and I didn't get a fair trial. So
yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting. There are, you know, the confrontation clause in the Constitution does seem to put up certain roadblocks in the way of virtual adjudication. At the same time, we already allow certain virtual hearings. We allow, say, child sex abuse victims sometimes to be shielded. So I think we're already chipping away at some of these ideas. And I think that the idea about, you know, why we had a confrontation clause in the first place, you know, a lot of it had to do with, you know, the idea of, you know, the Crown coming forward with, you know, secret accusers. It wasn't about dealing with problems that I'm mentioning.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right. Right.
So Just a second. I'm getting a little bit of a beeping sound. Are you hearing that?
I'm not, but we're going to wrap up anyway.
Okay,
perfect. This was amazing, man. And you're welcome back anytime. And I think you're doing a real service. I really do. I think this book is so important, and I think it's just one of those things that, you know, it's a privilege to talk to you, and also just, you know, you're making a huge difference.
I really appreciate that. You know, this has been the most fun interview I've done. I have to admit, it may be, you know, it may be the laughing
that
really helps. You know, it's hard often talking about such a serious subject, because I think, you know, you want to just be grave about it, but at the same time, I mean, I think there's an energy here which gets lost when you try to be really, really buttoned up all the time.
Yeah, man, you need to keep these things loose. That's what, you know, Hunter and I were like, look, I'm an actor and a comedian, but I'm the bridge. There are so many great ideas that are stuck in books. There are so many answers to problems. You're one of them. The book is Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice by Professor Adam Benforado, but you know, the point is that it's so important to get these ideas out there. You know, read some of the book if you don't read the whole book, but it's just too important, and it could affect your life. You could be accused wrongly of something. You know,
I mean, that's the lesson. It is. I mean, I bet, you know, if you think about the people listening right now, every one of them has been affected by the criminal justice system.
Yes.
All of us, we're called for jury duty. We are witnesses,
yes.
Right? We have friends who get locked up. There are people we went to high school with who get, you know, on the wrong side of the law. I mean, all of us.
It's even more than that. We all have a sense of fair play. I think that even children from a very young age have an understanding of what fair is and what unfair is. That's really cuts across all cultures and all time periods, I think. And you know, that's kind of what this speaks to as well, is that there is a way to make the justice system more fair.
Yeah, and I feel like as Americans, I mean, one of the things that I feel like we've lost sense of is we are courageous and we're willing to take risks and we're willing to change things when they're not working. I mean, I think that's what defines us as a country. And so the idea that we would just stick with our status quo and say, well, this is good enough, it's worked well enough for us.
Right.
I think that's an anti-American idea, honestly. I think when there are better ways to do it, we embrace them, we take the risk, and we go forward.
Well, there it is, ladies and gentlemen. Professor Adam Benforado, thank you so much for your work. You make a difference, sir, and I find it fun and a privilege to speak to somebody like yourself.
It was a real privilege. Thanks so much.
You're a good man, my friend.
Thanks, sir.
All right, take care.
See you later.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.